Benner with the Shelbourne Knee Center podcast, and we're coming to you today. I'm coming to you today on location for the first time from the Campbell Clinic Triennial Meeting in Memphis, Tennessee, at the lovely Peabody Hotel. If you're ever visiting Memphis, great place to stay, and looking forward to a great couple days of academic sessions down here in Memphis. Today, we have a great guest on from California joining us today to discuss ACL reconstruction outcomes and ACL registry data from the Kaiser Permanente Registry. And our guest today is Dr. Greg Miletus. He's an orthopedic surgeon at Kaiser Permanente. He's a clinical professor at the Kaiser Permanente School of Medicine, as well as the Keck School of Medicine at USC. And he's the lead of the Kaiser Permanente National ACL Registry and team physician for the LA Football Club in Los Angeles. So, Dr. Miletus, thank you for joining us, and looking forward to a great discussion about lessons learned from the Kaiser Permanente National ACL Registry. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
Scott Bauman, our co-host, is here with us as well, and we've known Greg for a while now. He's a longtime friend of the Shelbourne Knee Center. He's visited our center, a couple times, Greg? Have you been out to Indianapolis to visit with Don?
I have been, yes.
Yeah, we always love having him, and interesting discussion always when we're able to look at our database of 7,000 ACL reconstructions with Dr. Miletus's experience from the Kaiser Permanente Registry of thousands of ACL reconstructions as well. So, Greg, let's jump right in. Tell us about the registry from the beginning stages. Where did it start? How did it get developed? And what initial goals did you have with the development of the registry?
Well, we initially started in, let me back up. We started a total joint registry first at Kaiser, and that was because of the success of the Swedish hip register. Back in the late 70s, they were able to show that they could change practice in the surgeons in Sweden and actually improve their outcomes. And so in 2004, we started with a total hip and total knee registry in Kaiser. Myself being a sports guy and doing a lot of ACL surgery, I pushed really hard to say we needed to have an ACL registry too. And so in 2005, we actually started the ACL registry. And the real kind of defining moment was I work at Kaiser, and Kaiser is a fairly large health organization. And we converted to an electronic medical record at that time. And so for the first time, we could actually capture data on large numbers of patients from multiple different locations. Mm-hmm. We had tried doing some studies in the past, especially around ACL, with some getting some different groups together to combine patients, and it was just a challenge. But once we got the electronic medical record, all of a sudden it opened up a huge window of opportunity for us that we could capture data from multiple different centers. So 2005 is when we started. Some of our goals in starting this is we thought we could provide a real world look at clinical practice and also hopefully detect procedures and devices that resulted in premature failure. And we were also hoping we could identify prognostic factors for both good and poor outcomes. And then ultimately, we were hoping to be able to improve treatment outcomes by feeding back our results from what we had learned and also giving surgeons their own personal data so that they could see their own personal results. And we thought maybe by doing those things, we could improve overall outcomes in our patients.
And for those that may not be as familiar with the Kaiser group, tell us a little bit about the group and how many surgeons are in it how long it's been around, things like that.
Well, I don't know if I have all the answers. It's been around since, I think, the 40s. it's an organization that currently covers about somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 million patients. It's heavily weighted on the West Coast in both Northern and Southern California. And then also in the Pacific Northwest, but there are also Kaiser facilities in Hawaii and Colorado and also in what we call the Mid-Atlantic states. But the bulk of the patients are on the West Coast of the United States. And in the registry now, we have about 350 different surgeons who have participated, who have contributed patients. This registry for us is a voluntary registry. We ask all the surgeons to contribute. And so fortunately, everybody's been pretty willing, and we have a compliance rate or participation rates up in the 90%. range, which is quite important. If you're going to do a registry, you have to know what the denominator is. You have to know how many patients actually sure. had this procedure, so that then when you look at the outcomes, you can understand those rates. If you're just getting some participation, it's not nearly as helpful. So most registries have been in countries that have national health care, especially the Scandinavian countries. Mm-hmm. Norway was really the first. They started in 2004.
Australia,
Sweden,
as well.
And Denmark started in 2005, right about the same time that we started. And now there are others in New Zealand and a few other places. Germany is working on starting one. And so anyway, that's sort of the genesis of it.
That's quite a collaboration, garbage in, garbage out. If you have a registry like that, you really, really, it is predicated upon getting great information from the participating surgeons and getting the right things in on the front end. I mean, you're totally handcuffed on the back end unless you get great participation from those involved. So that's great stuff, and not an easy thing, I'm sure, to be able to pull off.
We're in an interesting system because people are in general pretty willing. You know, I think if we could make it so that it doesn't take them a lot of time, and I'll tell you, that's the huge challenge mm-hmm. of a yep. registry is for myself as a researcher, I would love to collect all kinds of data. I would collect, yep. you know, all kinds of different things. But if I were to ask all these other surgeons who really don't have that same level of interest to do that, our participation would be terrible and it would be useless information, really. So it's a real balance on what's absolutely necessary, what's desirable, and what's just not feasible when you're trying to collect data. So there are that leads to some of the limitations of a registry is that we don't have the granularity of data that you may get in a study like, or a group like the Moon Group, or clearly in the work that you do with at the Shelbourne Clinic. The granularity of data you get is absolutely phenomenal. And so there's just no way that we can get that. And I think it's important that people understand that there are lots of different kinds of research that you do, and none of them answer every question, but we need all of it to try to point mm-hmm. us closer and closer to the truth. But there are certain questions that we can answer that others can't, and a lot of questions that we can't answer just because we don't have that kind of data that others are far better at answering.
Well, you mentioned the granularity aspect of it, and those are just gigantic numbers. And I think that's amazing that you guys have so much input with data and participation with this registry. You know, I look at our database at the Shelbourne Knee Center just about every day, and it can get, you know, daunting just with a two-surgeon clinic. You know, I can't imagine what a registry would look like from a database standpoint. So my question for you with those large numbers would be, is there a standard? I mean, are there certain parameters you want every surgeon to report? Things like your typical demographics, of course, but then, you know, graft choice, meniscus tears, those types of things? Or is it really independent and based on what the individual surgeon wants to place into the registry?
No, it's very prescribed. So we have, you know, I think when we do our 2023 data, we'll probably be up in the neighborhood of about 70,000 cases. And so we have a whole team of people who help us to collate all this data. And much of it has now been automated. But we get certain pieces of data from the electronic medical record, such as age and gender and BMI and smoking history and associated medical comorbidities and things like that. And then at the time of surgery, there's a specific form that every surgeon fills out. And started off on paper, but now it's all electronic. And so that gives us the sport that the person was participating in at the activity they were participating in. We know when the injury occurred, so we can figure out time from injury to surgery. And then we look at whether this was the first operation or that person had a prior operation on that knee, so that we know if the meniscus had previous surgery or was essentially normal, or whether there had been a prior ligament injury. We look at concomitant injuries, other ligament injuries at the time of surgery, and then at the surgical findings, such as the status of the meniscus and then what was done, if there was a meniscus tear. Was it debrided or was it repaired? How it was repaired, if it was inside-out sutures or all-inside devices. And then we look at the type of graft, what size the graft was, and we look at how the tunnels were drilled. So every surgeon has to fill all of that out, and how they fixed it, what fixation devices were used. So those are all structured data fields so that they can be extracted on the back end and go into the larger database. And again, we have a team of folks because we have not only the ACL registry, but a total joint registry, a spine registry, hip fracture registry, total shoulder registry. So they've automated a lot of these different things. For our outcomes, though, we do what we call active surveillance on our outcomes. So we don't rely on the surgeons to tell us if a patient had a revision or not or a reoperation, because that tends to be fairly inaccurate. But once a patient has been registered, each year they get scanned so that we can see if they've had any new episodes, any new operations. And if so, then somebody actually goes to that chart and looks at it to see if it was truly a revision, if it was a one-stage or two-stage revision. We should get a form from the surgeon on that, but we don't actually trust that we could be missing things. So we go electronically and look at everybody and then see if there have been some new events. And we have some algorithms that show us if somebody's had a DVT or an infection. We have some pretty good algorithms that can identify certain factors that will then trigger an actual person to go and look at it to validate.
So you touched on it just a little bit when you talked about the granularity of things and the registry data being different than places similar to ours, where we'd be, you know, a smaller clinic that's looking at different data points. But, you know, big picture wise, knowing you've been doing this for quite a long time now, what would you say are the biggest advantages of having a registry of your nature and of your size, and if any disadvantages to that?
Yeah, I think that the large size allows us to look at things that don't have frequent outcomes. And quite frankly, revisions are, you know, not all that common. They're kind of in most cases, in the single digit or, you know, that percentage range. So when you don't have things that happen frequently, it helps a lot to have larger numbers, especially looking at things like infections. Or we can start to look at other factors that may play into risks of revision, say, such as age, such as the graft type. And age and graft type together end up being probably quite important. When we look in our organization, we were doing a lot of allografts. And so we wanted to look at allografts in particular and figure out what are the processing methods and do those make a difference? So both processing and age. So you really need to have large numbers to be able to discriminate or to separate out all of those different factors. So that's where the advantage of the big numbers. Now, the disadvantage gets back to what I was mentioning before. We just don't have granularity. I can't tell you about patients' range of motion or when they went back to sports or what their KT numbers were or are, or what level of sports they were doing. We know what sport, but I can't tell you if they were collegiate level or if they were high school level or recreational level. So when we're looking at our data, we don't have that sort of granularity, and that's really important. And the other big thing that we're missing is patient-reported outcomes. And we've worked on that in many different ways, and we just cannot get to a level that's acceptable to our epidemiologists. So we sent out forms, and this is a huge problem actually for most of the registries, is they settled primarily on the COOS as an outcome measure. And the COOS is probably a good osteoarthritis outcome, but really not very discriminating in ACL patients.
Absolutely.
And it started because that's how they started in Norway, and we all wanted to be able to compare our data, so we all kind of went that way. So we sent COOS forms to patients. And if we didn't get it back, we sent them a follow-up form. This was a subset of our group. And then we got about 40% response rates. So then we tried IKDC, same thing, no better. And IKDC is a little harder to fill out, so we wouldn't expect it to be better. Then we tried a mailer and then a phone call follow-up. And then still about the same, 40-something percent. I had the bright idea that for the patients who we had their cell phones, we should just text them and say, rate your knee on a scale of 1 to 100. How well does it function compared to your other knee? And I thought we would do great, but we got 44% with that. So it's really difficult. And that's, you know, what you guys do there is so phenomenal. I don't know that really a lot of people understand the amount of work and time, effort that it takes to get the kind of data that you get. And we just can't get that. I will tell you, in my patients during that time when we got 44%, I would tell patients, look, we're going to call you at, we're going to send you a note at 6 months and then at 1 year, and I need you to fill out this form. And if they didn't fill it out, I have my PA or my therapist call them. So in my patients, I could get about 85% follow-up. So, I mean, it's doable, but you have to have physician engagement. You have to have the resources to really go after the patients. And we can't do that with 70,000 patients. So that's a big limitation. And I will say, I do have some biases about patient-reported outcomes in ACLs. I just don't think we have good outcome measures to really separate out patients very well. Mm-hmm. So we've relied a lot on revision, but we're missing a whole group of patients who have not had a revision but are not doing well. We can't identify that group. So that's, I think, one of the big limitations for us, and even for all the registries, because we just, you know, we're too wedded to this coos, and everybody wants to change, but nobody's really figured out what to move to. So
But you identified a couple limitations that I think are kind of ubiquitous. I mean, I think that we definitely, it's a grind to be able to get people to be able to get follow up far enough down the road and at a big enough percentage with the right kind of metric, whether regardless of what whether you're picking Lysham or Tegner or IKDC or noise or what or Coos or whatever it is you're trying to pull out. It's a grind to be able to get response numbers that that are really actionable. And by virtue of the fact that I'm in clinic with Don Shelbourne all the times, and we're talking about and thinking about these things all the time, your point about reoperation being an endpoint and being something that people really focus on is really unfortunate. And you know, as you know from being familiar with our studies, and anybody else who's listening does, range of motion, we feel, is if you could pick out one thing that matters the most to people, to us, it's not stability, it's not graft choice, it's range of motion. That's the if you can get patients back to full extension, even if their stability is not great, they can still function really well. But if people don't get a great outcome and don't re-tear their graft, how many of those people are walking around would just say, well, my right knee is a bad knee now, and I just live with it, and they're not a failure, they're not a revision, they're not a re-tear, so they're not captured if your only metric is reoperation. So I think you hit the nail on the head, and we couldn't agree more with that. And you know, that's why we try to get at it in a different way, but it's an uphill battle when I think most surgeons out there are looking at it, think about it in those terms, that if the patient didn't have a reoperation, that they must have had a good outcome, and there's not another metric we want to focus on. So you know, a couple other things that I think were interesting about your database that I wanted to touch on, one being the fact that you said that you provide collective data for the entirety of the group, but you also give back individual data. And I think that sometimes, I'm sure, is a difficult thing for people to look at when all of a sudden you're looking at your results and maybe yours aren't as good as the doctor that's in the bay next to you in clinic who you've been going back and forth with. And you know, it's an interesting thing when you get longer term follow up and look at your own results next to other people's. I'm sure that can be sobering information for surgeons. So talk a little bit about that and having to have 350 different surgeons looking at themselves side to side and really shining a light on this is where you're at.
Yeah, so I think that it's important to understand a little bit about who owns the data in a setting like this. And we've actually always made it so that the surgeons own the data. Because if the surgeons thought that this was going to be a punitive thing for them, that somebody might be looking over their shoulder and saying, hey, you're not doing so well, you know, we don't want you doing this anymore, then they wouldn't be willing to participate. So nobody can look at any individual data except that individual. So even though I sort of run the registry, I can't see anybody else's individual data. Only that surgeon can see it. And so you can see where you stack up. We have these things that we call outlier reports. So we look at what the mean revision rates are, and then we look at two standard deviations above and below, and you can see where you fall, how many cases you've done, and where you fall in that, whether you're above or below the line. So you can get a sense of where you are, but you can't see where you're, you know, the guy in the next office over is. So we can look at it by hospital, and we can look at it by region, and then we can, each individual can look at it. And so that's been the basis for some of our, I think, most important work, is that we've seen that certain regions and certain hospitals really had significantly higher revision rates. And so I think that's, you know, I guess I would say this is probably our most important study, or at least the one that I feel the best about, is that we looked at, this was primarily around allografts. And so we looked at our allograft results and we said, look, allografts don't work nearly as well, especially in young people. So we published those papers and we spoke at meetings, but then we sent newsletters out to all the surgeons and said, here's our results. You know, you need to look at this. And then they got their results and they could see how many allografts they'd done, and they could see what their revision rates were, and they could compare it to the region or their hospital. But we found that there were certain regions that were doing significantly more allografts, even upwards of 50 to 60% of their cases were being done with allografts. Mm-hmm. I think it had to do with some local factors. A lot of the surgeons that were trained in those areas by some of the fellowships were very high allograft users, and that's what they were comfortable with. And so we went to those hospitals and those chiefs of the orthopedics at those hospitals, and we said, look, you know, this is what we see, and your revision rates are far higher. And this, we think, is why, because of all the allograft use. So we made it one of our chief's goals in about 2010 to all the chiefs of each orthopedic department meet quarterly. And every year we come up with some different goals as to how to improve orthopedic care. And so the agreed upon goal was to decrease allograft use, especially high risk allografts that were irradiated or chemically processed, because we found that those did far worse, but especially allograft use in young patients. So we just said anyone 21 or under, we really want to decrease that use. And so we went from, I want to say it was in the order of 25% of cases in that young group being done with allografts, with about a 7.5% revision rate at 2 years. And in 2017, we decreased that to 2.5% cases being done with allografts. So we were on an increasing trend of about 3% per quarter. And then we decreased that trend by about 4% per quarter, and our overall revision rate decreased significantly. So we wrote a paper, I think it was published about a year ago in JBJS, called an interrupted time series analysis, where we looked at our increasing rates and then this intervention, if you will, and then found that our rates of allograft use decreased. But more importantly, we actually saw that overall, in the entire registry, our revision rates decreased by decreasing our overall use of allografts. So to me, that's really the value of a registry, to try to identify things that aren't working as well, to figure out what practice patterns are, and then to see those practice patterns change. And ultimately, and this is the hardest thing, is to actually show that you've improved outcomes. We all try to do research, and we all hope that people will read our papers and that somehow it changes someone's mind about what they ought to do. But it's really difficult to know or to show that you've actually made an impact. And in a registry, because you can track practice patterns and you can track outcomes, it gives you the opportunity to be able to do that.
Yeah, no, another point that you made earlier that I think is a really important one that I also wanted to highlight. I think the pendulum has swung a long way, I feel like, away from, you know, kind of observational expert opinion research. And I understand why that is. Of course, the point is not lost on me that those type of study designs aren't anywhere near as statistically and scientifically pristine and valid and you know, set up in the best way possible. However, I feel like that kind of data is almost now just brushed aside as if it doesn't matter. And I think that's a big mistake. I don't know how many studies I read where we have a great study design, a level one randomized controlled trial where there's so many different things that are controlled for in order to find that there's no difference. And those are all great studies. But what do we learn from that if we don't find any differences in things over and over and over again, versus being able to publish? You know, this is something that we don't see very often. We've seen quite a few of them. Here's what we do, and here's what our results are. It's very important to acknowledge the limitations of studies such as that, but I also think you can learn a lot from things like that. And in registries in particular, you can not necessarily, like you talked about, you can not necessarily control for those things, but assess what factors are out there that you want to look at, figure out where you may be missing the mark, correct those that seem to be leading towards worse outcomes, and then be able to look back down the road and see that you've made an impact when you haven't actually controlled for any of those things, of those variables along the way. And to me, that's the real power of registry studies and of, you know, some expert opinion, you know, case control type studies that maybe are a little bit lower scientific quality if you're talking about levels of evidence, but can still get to the point that you need to get to and improve the outcomes for our patients. So, you know, as you talk about, think about your registry in those regards, you know, how do you feel like your registry kind of fits into that? There's a place for all kinds of studies.
Yeah, I think this gets back to my earlier point that we're all trying to answer the questions that we can answer. And you bring up a really important point that registry studies are observational studies, which means we can't determine causation. We're looking at associations. So we can look at the association of graph choice and risk of revision. But we can't say that because you use an allograft that caused the revision. We can just say that allografts are associated with higher risks of revision. So, We have to acknowledge that. But one of the values of registries, it's a real world look. This is what's happening. And mm-hmm. So when we do prospective randomized trials, they're very specific, and whether those are generalizable is really in question. I've done a prospective randomized trial on patellar tendons versus hamstrings. And I, you know, randomized 100 patients. It took me 200 patients to get 100 to be willing to be randomized. So the expense and the time of that study was pretty significant. And I didn't find any difference. Well, the problem was, you know, we had 48, 49 patients in each group at 2 years. And we had varying age ranges, varying sexes. And so we can't drill down. I can tell you that hamstrings have a higher risk of revision than patellar tendons do. And we've shown it in multiple studies. It probably is most important in young people and probably most important in young women. So we've shown that. The Scandinavians have all shown that. New Zealand has shown that. So that's a real world example. But when our studies then corroborate what you show or what is shown in a stability trial where hamstrings, you know, have more of an issue with revisions if you don't add something in young active people. So now we're all starting to kind of show similar things. So I don't think any one study or any one study design is perfect. Each one has its own issues. With a prospective randomized trial, it's really difficult to get the numbers available. And then you can only look at a couple of things when we can adjust for all sorts of different things, time of follow-up, age of patients, all these sorts of things. We can do statistical adjustments to be able to kind of isolate certain things. But yeah, it's not the same as if we had 70,000 patients that have been randomized to one or another technique. Obviously, you know, I'm being facetious, that's an impossible study.
Yeah. Well, what a powerful tool that you have at your disposal with that kind of observational research. I just think it's, as you said, it's not about I do this kind, so this one's more important, or they do this kind, so that one's more important. It's recognizing the contributions of both types of research and putting both of them into proper context and not throwing either of them to the side is when I feel like we really learn the most.
Yeah, and I think, again, when we start to come up with similar outcomes or similar conclusions with different types of studies, then I think we know we're onto something. For us, when we show similar things to the Moon Group is a group of specialized surgeons and a cohort of a couple thousand patients, but they can't show the same things that we can show. But in some ways, we hit the exact same thing. And if they've shown that and we've shown that, and then all of a sudden New Zealand shows that or Norway shows that, then we go, okay, we're probably approaching the truth here.
I think we got
this. Yeah, that's what we're all after. Pardon me?
Yeah, I think we got this. Yes, all these registries are pointing in the right direction. I think we got this.
So of course every study design is going to have its strengths and its weaknesses. And I love the example that you gave on the revisions. And to me, you know, coming from the research side of things, that seems to be what it's all about. You know, whether you come up with a randomized controlled trial or you're looking at observational registry data, you recognize a problem through an association. You make some changes, and like you said, with the association of allografts leading to higher revisions, there was a talk with the chiefs about decreasing the allograft usage to be able to drive revisions down. And it sounded like that worked. So that's amazing. And that's, to me, what research is all about in terms of improving outcomes. Now, with other aspects, you know, either staying inside the revision realm or whatever realm you want to speak to, without giving away any secrets, obviously, but are there any other trends that you guys are seeing through the registry data that's leading to the association similar to the revisions or any types of better outcomes that may be related to graft choice or meniscus injuries or anything of that nature?
Yeah, we did a study a few years back. Actually, one of my colleagues, Brent Davis, was the lead author, and he said, look, revision isn't the only outcome. Now, revision is a very good outcome because both the surgeon and the patient have agreed that there's a problem. So it's a very good outcome in that respect, and it's very clean because you can identify it easily. But, you know, like we've talked about, we're missing a lot. And so we took a cohort of patients who had no meniscus injuries in their operative knee or their contralateral knee. And then we looked at those who had different grafts. Primarily it was hamstrings or patellar tendon. And the thought was that if we are doing a good job kinematically of restoring the knee to normal, if you will, obviously none of us think that we're making them normal, but the better that we can kinematically improve them, theoretically, we should see fewer meniscus tears going forward. So in both groups, both our patellar tendon group and the hamstring group, we did see more subsequent meniscus tears than the contralateral knee. Not surprising. But what we did find was that patellar tendons had a lower risk of a subsequent meniscus injury in a previously normal a knee with a normal meniscus than the hamstring group. I mean, our conclusion was, again, this is just an observational study, but we thought that there was an association there that, and we made some statements, you know, suggesting that maybe this was because the kinematics were better. We had made these knees more stable, and therefore it was that graft was better at protecting the meniscus. We're working a lot now on quadriceps tendon. Quad tendons have become a very popular thing over the past, you know, 5 to 7 years, I think. And so we've seen an increase in our quad tendon use from about 0% or 2%, you know, 7 years ago to almost 20% now in our registry. We've seen, again, a significant decrease in allograft use, but we've seen a corresponding decrease in hamstring use and a slight increase in our patellar tendon use. I think, again, we've seen, you know, we've reported multiple times that hamstrings have a higher risk of revision. All the Scandinavian registries have as well, in New Zealand. So we are seeing changes there. With quad tendons, I think we just wrote a paper that was published in American Journal of Sports Medicine fairly recently. And what we found was that there was no significant difference in the risk of revision when we compared quad tendons and patellar tendons. And also when we compared quad tendons and hamstring tendons. But our overall numbers are still pretty different. We had almost 10,000 patellar tendons, almost 10,000 hamstrings, but we only had 1,000 quad tendons. That's still a big number, but on par, it's not quite the same. And our quad tendon data, we really only had out to 4 years, whereas our hamstring and patellar tendons, we could look out to 9 years. So patellar tendons, significantly lower risk of revision than hamstrings. We've shown that multiple times and showed that again in this study. But what we looked at here was what we call the number needed to treat. And so sometimes when, you know, we report hazard ratios a lot, because hazard ratios help us when we have varying times of follow-up. So you can, using a hazard ratio, you can take those, the follow-up time into account, as opposed to an odds ratio where you have to have, say, 2-year follow-up and you can tell the odds, you can present the odds ratio. So we use hazard ratios a lot, but I think sometimes those are hard to really wrap your head around or put into practice if we say it's a 1.4 times higher risk. So in this case, when we look at numbers needed to treat, what we can say is, if you were to do a quad tendon instead of a hamstring tendon, for every 30 cases, you would save one revision. So if you had done all those as hamstrings instead, you would expect one more revision every 30 cases you do. And with patellar tendons, it's about patellar tendons versus hamstrings, it's about every 36 cases. So to me, that helps me to kind of understand, I can at least wrap my head around what that means. You know, if I'm every 30 cases, yeah, that's something that's, I want to think about that. I want to pay attention to that. If it's every 300 and something cases, which it is when we look at quad tendons or patellar tendons, I'm probably not going to change my practice based on that kind of a number, because, yeah, there may be other factors involved there too. So anyway, we're looking a lot at quad tendons, and I really want to look at, I think the biggest thing is young females. That's where I think that's where the biggest issues are. When people use hamstrings, that's where we've seen bigger problems. So I want to see what happens when we look at our quad tendons in that young female population.
A quick question about those quad tendons. I think we talked about this a little bit when we saw each other at Academy. Have you looked at those quad tendons at the reoperation rates, not necessarily revision rates, but reoperation rates? I know there was one study at last year's sports medicine meeting that showed a significant percentage of quadricep tendon ACL reconstructions that had stiffness and required reoperations for arthrofibrosis. I believe it was about 6% of quad tendon ACL reconstructions in that study. I can't remember who did it, but that there was a worry in my mind, at least, as people move towards quad tendons. Is there an increased risk of stiffness?
Yeah, I think that was a big concern of mine as well. That study showed, I think it was maybe 7.2% of the patients that had their quad tendons had a reoperation. Yeah. It was John X who wrote that one. And I believe it was an arthroscopy. So I was concerned about that as well. So I did look specifically at stiffness, and what we found was patients who had a reoperation for stiffness with a quad tendon graft, it was 2.4%. With a patellar tendon graft, it was 2.6%. And with a hamstring graft, it was 1.8%. So slightly higher than the hamstrings for both quad tendon and patellar tendon, but no difference between those two.
Pretty similar.
And still pretty low numbers, at least in my mind.
Well, as we continue down that thread of lessons learned from the Kaiser Registry, I think, a lean towards maybe some better outcomes with patellar tendons with regard to revision rates and meniscus tears. I couldn't agree more in what we found. Obviously, we're all patellar tendon all the time, so you don't have to convince me not to use hamstring grafts. But it seems to be something that keeps popping up in registry studies, and when I go to academy and subspecialty meetings, that the hamstrings just seem to have a higher revision rate. And I think it's time for everybody to just say that's just a fact. If you're a hamstring surgeon, you choose not to act on that in the way that I think we should, then that's fine. But I think that seems to be more and more reproducible. As you talked about earlier, multiple registries have shown that over time. For me, the evidence is clear, and the way to take care of that is to not do hamstrings anymore. What do you think are some other ways? I don't know. I can't remember. Are you all patella tendons, or are you using some hamstrings as well?
You know, I trained primarily doing patellar tendons. I did use some hamstrings many years ago, and that was kind of why I did this prospective randomized trials. I just didn't know if one was better than the other. And I couldn't really see differences. This was published in AJSM back, I can't remember, in the late 90s, I think. And it was part of the Cochrane Review. I think it was a really well-done study. I couldn't see differences, but we did see that slightly higher rate of return to higher level sports with the patellar tendon group. That was the one significant difference. There was a little bit more kneeling pain in the patellar tendon group as well. But my personal feeling was that those patients just felt looser to me. And so until we really did our first study back in 2010, I think, although we started getting data back in maybe 2008, and we started showing that, it kind of fit with what my own clinical perception was. And so I really started backing away from using hamstrings. I do think there are some patients who can do just fine with hamstrings, and especially some older patients maybe who put less stress on their overall graft. Now, you might argue that maybe they didn't need surgery in the first place. I still use some allografts in that group, and the patients over 40, I think that they actually do pretty well. We see such low revision rates in our patients over 40 that I'll still do that. But I use patellar tendon as sort of my primary graft, although I have started using quadriceps tendons some. And I'm not I think that this study made me feel more comfortable with that. I wasn't sure initially. My perception was that they were doing well, and certainly there have been a lot of other well-done smaller studies that showed good results. But until I really saw our data, I wasn't completely comfortable with it, but I am now. I'm not sure if there's going to be a difference, and this is probably a question we won't answer, about comorbidities that go along with the graft. I think that gets overemphasized. I don't find it to be such a big deal, even with the patellar tendons. Mm-hmm. But for some people who do spend a lot of time on their knees, I'll usually lean towards a quadriceps graft in them. So I don't do a lot of hamstrings. In fact, I think last year I didn't do any. Maybe the last couple of years I didn't do any when I saw my data. Occasionally, if a patient's had it in the past on the other knee and wants it, I'll still do it if I can't talk them out of it. Mm-hmm. I use allograft fairly rarely, primarily only in patients over 40. I used to use allograft for revisions, but we just wrote a paper, and the Mars group has written a couple of papers showing allografts and revisions don't do nearly as well. So I've learned from Dr. Shelbourne that the contralateral knee is a pretty great source of a graft. And so I have no qualms if I have to do a revision going there. That's sort of been my evolution, I think.
Have you noticed a similar evolution when looking at the registry data over the years? I know at our group, we were looking at the ACL study group in terms of the graft choice usage over time, and it's really a fascinating metric when you look at what was being used 20, 30 years ago and what people are using now. So have you seen something similar since the adoption of the registry in their mid-2000s to now in terms of what grafts people are using then and what it's transitioned to now?
Yeah, we were, I think I mentioned before, we were seeing increasing allograft use. There was a time where people just seemed to have really gravitated towards using that. I have residents who work with me, and there was a series of residents who hadn't seen any autografts done. It was shocking to me until they came to operate with me. But so we were seeing increasing allograft use, increasing hamstring use. And if you still look around the world, hamstring is the dominant graft. And then in our registry, though, we've seen a significant decrease in allograft, especially in the young population. We've seen a slight decrease in hamstrings. We were 30%+. We're down to mid-20%. We were at mid-20% with patellar tendons, and we've seen that increase up to about 30-something%. And again, quad tendons have gone from essentially zero to at least 20%. And that was in, I want to say, 2022. So I think when 2023 data rolls around, we're actually going to see a big jump there too. Seems like at the ACL study group and other places, quad tendons have really become a very popular graft around the world.
So similar to trends with graft choice and things like that, have you seen any trends with the registry data as it relates to the treatment of meniscus tears at the time of ACL surgery?
Well, we do record that data, and we did a collaborative study with Norway very early on and looked at our two registries to kind of see similarities and differences. And one of the real differences was the numbers of patients that we repaired their meniscus in compared to Norway. They did far fewer meniscus repairs. That's since changed. They actually have repaired far more. And we were initially collecting pretty granular data, trying to look at the different zones of repair and how many sutures were used and how many fixation devices. We found that we just didn't feel like our data was very accurate. So we've actually just now kind of moved to, was the meniscus repaired or not? Was it debrided or not? Was it rasped or trephinated or not? And then if it was repaired, was it all inside sutures? Or all inside suture devices, or was it inside out sutures? And so that's really where we are. We haven't looked at a lot of outcomes based on the meniscal status or whether patients have had repeat meniscus surgeries, other than the one study where I mentioned where we looked at patients who had no meniscus tears and tried to look at the impact of graft choice on subsequent meniscus tears. So I can't tell you a lot about the impact of meniscus tears yet on ACL results or on repeat surgeries for meniscus.
Yeah, Greg, one of our frustrations when we read meniscus tear studies is the lumping of all types of meniscus tears into the same bucket. Is it medial? Is it lateral? Is it degenerative or is it non-degenerative? Is it displaceable or is it non-displaceable? Is it peripheral or is it central? Is it in a vascularized zone? Is it not in a vascularized zone? Is it the time of an ACL reconstruction or not? So there's just so many different variables to look at. And I think it's difficult for me, at least, to be able to learn much from studies that just say, here's a bunch of meniscus tears that we did, and here's the results. I have a hard time learning a lot from those. So something that we've been getting some data on for quite a while that hopefully we can continue to make some comments on. But I understand what you're saying about the difficulty in characterizing tears, specific tears. Tears that you see at specific times and how you treat them. There's just so many variables.
Yeah, with like you say, large numbers of surgeons to agree or to have everybody kind of come to the same conclusion. You know, the Moon Group, when they were doing their studies, they actually made everybody get together and they set out ground rules. This is what we're going to agree to. This is, you know, how we're going to define these things. And certainly in our setting, you know, we have some surgeons who are very interested and a whole lot who really are, you know, they're willing to do it as long as it doesn't take more than a minute or two after their case. Yep. And so, it's really one of our limitations. But you're right. I think there's so many nuances to meniscus tears, what heals, what doesn't, what is a problem, what isn't, that I think that we are really, you know, we rely on groups like yours where you have very exact data on those things, and it's the same couple of surgeons who are entering the data, so you know that you are calling things the same. So those are challenges that I don't think that we're gonna sort out on my end, at least.
Yeah. Well, Greg, thanks for joining us again. We really appreciate all your contributions that you've made to ACL treatment and things like that. And, we've always enjoyed having you to visit us and speaking with you at meetings and, expressing our kind of commonalities. It's been fun to discuss these things with you. So thanks again for joining us. As we kind of wrap up here, what would you say are the take-home messages for those people that are listening today about lessons learned from the Kaiser ACL registry? What are those take-home points that you'd like to hit?
Well, I guess maybe just in broader terms as to kind of reiterate, you know, what a registry can do. A registry can really help to determine good and poor outcomes. I think you can get a longitudinal look at practice patterns. And I think if you really look at it and work hard, you can demonstrate changes in practice and hopefully outcomes over time. That's really what our goal is in research, is to identify things that work well and don't work, and then hopefully get people to move towards that direction. So for me, it's not just the specific lessons of use this graft or use that graft in this patient. Yeah, I think those are important things. But if maybe the bigger point is that registries can help, and they don't answer all questions, but there are certain things where you can really show some good outcomes. And if you can show that you translate those outcomes and change overall practice, then I think you can say that maybe you did something important at the end of the day.
Excellent. I couldn't agree with you more there, Dr. Miletus, and just want to take this opportunity to thank you for coming on here. I know from, you know, us in Indianapolis and doing some work with our database, we've really looked to your registry data and learned a lot from what you guys have done. And I really enjoyed reading your stuff and hearing you talk at different meetings. So having you on here was a real pleasure, and I appreciate you coming on here.
Hey, well, thank you guys very much. I've enjoyed my time out there in Indianapolis. I've learned a lot from Dr. Shelbourne and you. And Scott, you're doing a great job with continuing on with the research there. It's such an impressive database. I'm so enamored with what you guys have done. I just don't think anybody else, I actually can't think of anybody in the world who's done this, but certainly anybody in the United States who has put together this kind of data over this kind of this period of time. The effort that it's taken to do this is really a testament to Dr. Shelbourne, but also Tinker and Scott, you and mm-hmm. Rodney and the whole team out there. You guys have really taught us all a lot. A lot of what I do is from what I learned with Dr. Shelbourne.
Yep. Shout out to Shelbourne and shout out to Tinker Gray as well today at the end of this episode. So thanks again, Greg, for joining us. Join us again next time, everyone. If you continue to listen to us, you can hit us up on our social media at SKC Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. You can find us on our Facebook and YouTube pages at the Shelbourne Knee Center Podcast. If you'd like to send us a question, you can email us at the SKC Podcast at gmail.com. If you follow us, you can get all of our content. Make sure you don't miss any episodes. Make sure to go back through the old episodes. There's a lot of great content on there already. And if you like what you hear, give us a follow and leave us a 5-star review. And we'll see you back next week. This has been Dr. Greg Miletus joining myself and Scott Bauman on the Shelbourne Knee Center Podcast. And we'll talk to you soon.